KPBS On Demand is supported by Pacific Arts Movement, presenting the 25th San Diego Asian Film Festival, November 7th to 16th at theaters across San Diego, showcasing films from China, Philippines, South Korea, and Vietnam. For tickets and information, go to sdaff.org.
It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. Today we'll tell you where you can find the best recipes from the region, a comedic rendition of Dracula, and what NPR's Ari Shapiro is up to in your weekend preview. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. A new cookbook showcases the diversity of San Diego's culinary landscape and how you can bring it into your own kitchen.
Whether you are a beginner in the kitchen or are looking to level up what you're already doing, you'll find that there are a number of recipes in this cookbook for all home cooks.
Plus, we'll tell you how comedy and Dracula are coming together on stage and your weekend arts preview. That's ahead on Midday Edition. San Diego has a thriving culinary landscape. A new cookbook looks to showcase the best of our local restaurants and what they have to offer, and how you can bring it into your own kitchen. KPBS Metro reporter Andrew Bowen spoke with LaGaia Malones, author of San Diego Cooks, and Karen Krasny, executive pastry chef at Extraordinary Desserts. Here's that conversation.
LaGaia, I'll start with you. How did this cookbook come to be? I hear it was a very long journey.
It was. It took about 5 years to produce. And the way it came about, I have been reporting on the local food scene for a number of years. And when the publisher, Figure One, approached me with this opportunity, I, along with Deanna Sandoval, the photographer on the project, thought, what a great opportunity to showcase the culinary diversity of our region.
What do you think makes our regions of San Diego and the food scene here so unique?
Yeah, I expand on this point in the introduction of San Diego Cooks, but a couple of things that immediately come to mind and that has been echoed by the restaurants and chefs that I've had the opportunity to interview for the book include our great weather, which provides an incredibly long growing season. And so our restaurants have access to produce for longer in the season compared to elsewhere in the country. Our proximity to Mexico and also the abundance of our oceans and our inland regions as well.
What are some of the restaurants and recipes that you're most excited about featuring in this book?
I'm excited to feature a range of recipes from across the region and to highlight the various dining styles our region has to offer. And so, you know, you'll find San Diego Cooks includes recipes from everywhere from Bonita with TJ Oyster Bar to Oceanside, like Petite Madeline Cafe, from casual spots like Nectarine Grove in Encinitas, and Smoke and Jay's Barbecue in Poway and the Gaslamp Quarter, to our fine dining establishments such as Avant and Rancho Bernardo, Valle and Matsu in Oceanside, as well as Karen's establishment, Extraordinary Desserts.
Yeah, Karen, so tell me, how did Extraordinary Desserts first get involved in this project?
Well, we heard about the project, and because I'm a native San Diegan and I've been here with my two restaurants for 30 plus years, it just seemed like a natural fit.
And I'll ask you the same question. What do you think makes San Diego's culinary scene stand out?
I think it's just growing and growing and growing. And so I think we're just seeing a lot more restaurateurs and chefs come our way and just sort of enlighten whatever we started, you know, so many years ago. And because of the availability of the, you know, particularly the fruits, the vegetables, the seafood. And, you know, it's really easy to get things here. It seems like even if they're not local. So I think our relaxed atmosphere, I mean, I think that adds to it. More people are becoming educated about the kinds of things that we all do. So it's just growing, and it's kind of exciting to be involved in something that just continues to, you know, move the culinary movement in that way.
Let's talk about some of the recipes in the book. So Extraordinary Desserts is famous for its lemon meringue cake. You also have a cookie recipe in here, Karen. Why did you choose those two recipes for the book?
I knew I had to do a cake because that's what we're really recognized for. And I didn't want to do something that was too difficult that would take someone too long to do that would not be interesting. So real accessible. And I wanted something that maybe wasn't focused on berries. So lemons seem natural. I mean, you can get lemons pretty much any time of the year and anywhere you are. So that was that. The other with the cookie is I always try to do something for someone who either has a gluten-free intolerance or, you know, they eat plant-based. And so I wanted to find something alternative that is just as delicious, but very simple and easy to do.
And tell me about how you go about crafting new desserts or new recipes. What inspires you? What do you put into that?
I would say that new recipes come and it's like a lightning bolt. I don't really know when and how. I might be reading a magazine about, you know, the Maldives. I could be on an airplane. I could be, I start getting really into something. And then I start seeing it in print or, you know, somewhere I'm in a grocery store or something. And, you know, it just seems to be on this loop. And then something happens for me. But we're constantly, whether it's ice cream or a new scone or a new Danish or something, we're constantly doing something new. I would say at least every week to two.
LaGaia, Karen mentioned that she likes to include recipes that are accessible, but also maybe have a little bit of a challenge in them. Who did you have in mind as you were writing this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So San Diego Cooks is for all home cooks at any level. And we, meaning Dee Sandoval, photographer on the project, and myself were very intentional about curating recipes with varying degrees of complexity. And so whether you are a beginner in the kitchen or are looking to level up what you're already doing or really want to challenge yourself, you'll find that there are a number of recipes in this cookbook for all home cooks.
And LaGaia, as a food and travel writer, how have you seen San Diego's food scene change?
I think the word that comes to mind is diversity in all its forms. For example, the geographic diversity of the restaurants and options available to us. We now have more options than ever to dine out and patronize restaurants, cafes, bars across the county, from Oceanside to La Mesa, where maybe it was a little more difficult. And Karen, correct me if I'm wrong. Just 5-10 years ago, it was a little more difficult to just kind of rattle off a number of neighborhoods where you could find some really good food.
Very true. Very true.
Karen, Extraordinary Desserts opened back in the late 80s as a small cafe. Can you take us back to when you first opened this business? What was it like?
It was like the desert. Not dessert, desert. I mean, there was really not much going on. And I've said this many times. We were one of five coffee houses in the city. And now there's over 5,000. So we were doing a lot of education about olés and lattes and cappuccinos and, you know, what is ganache and what's curd versus marmalade. You know, it's just a lot of talking to people about things they might not have really known that well.
And of course, as you say, the culinary landscape of San Diego has really grown since you first opened your business. How have you seen things change both for your business and the restaurant industry?
Well, I think that with so many more restaurants, we're getting more trained from back of the house to front of the house. You're seeing where people have worked before and have been trained well. And I think that's something that we lacked maybe a long time ago. We had a few fine dining restaurants in the city and, you know, you could get really good service there. And then I think as we began to grow, people were moving from different places throughout the United States and Europe, and they'd had a lot of training in whether it was food prep or in customer service. And that just sort of made more of a model for all of us here to kind of aspire to get better and do better.
LaGaia, you've mentioned the photographer who you collaborated with on this book. I've always wondered how you get those pictures in these cookbooks that are so perfect. Can you walk me through what the photo shoots were like?
Yeah, we had 1 week-long photo shoot where all of our featured restaurants came to the studio we rented, and we, Dee, along with our food stylist, Taylor, created the beautiful food imagery you see in the book. And what I really appreciate about Dee's food images is that she really focuses on the details and textures of the dish, which I think lend itself to helping our home cooks visualize what they'll be making in their own kitchen.
Did you get to eat the meals after photographing them?
Oh, yes.
And what was your favorite?
Nearly everything, or I will say everything I tasted was delicious. And you know, beyond the photo shoot, I have a couple of go-to recipes. So there is one recipe that is a chilaquiles recipe from Mystic Mocha in University Heights. I like to pull that recipe out on the weekends. There is also a Brussels sprouts recipe with honey chili glaze and sesame dressing from Chef Moira Hill that has made a Brussels sprouts believer out of my boyfriend. And I have bookmarked Karen's Aloha peanut butter cookie recipe for a weekend activity to do with my boyfriend's daughter.
Karen, what do you hope that readers take away after looking through this book and seeing the recipes that you've contributed to it?
Well, I'm hoping that anybody that purchases the book starts to believe that San Diego is more than just a seaside town, and that there's actually really talented artists and artisans and restaurateurs here in our city, because there definitely are. And it's a reason to come to San Diego for more than just the zoo and you know, our beautiful weather.
And LaGaia, how about you? What do you want readers to take away?
I would echo Karen's sentiments. And I mentioned this, expand on this rather, in the introduction of the cookbook, that yes, San Diego is and has been known as a tacos and craft beer town. We have excellent tacos and craft beer and so much more.
That was KPBS Metro reporter Andrew Bowen speaking with San Diego Cooks author LaGaia Malones and Karen Krasny, executive pastry chef at Extraordinary Desserts. Coming up, it is Halloween season and no better time to see a new spin on a classic gothic story. Beth Accomando will preview Dracula at the Old Globe. Hear more when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalich, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. This Halloween season, the play Dracula has taken up residence at the Old Globe Theater. But this time, it's taking a comedic spin on the classic gothic tale. KPBS arts reporter Beth Accomando goes behind the scenes to find out what goes into creating a so-called comedy of terrors.
I'm here at the Old Globe Theater in the dressing room of actors George Crissa and Drew Drogi. On stage, they play Dracula and his nemesis, Dr. Van Helsing. Now, Dracula is a very iconic figure. So first of all, I just wanted to find out, what was your prior knowledge of Dracula or Bram Stoker before you started this project? And George, do you want to start?
Yeah, well, I mean, like everybody, I think we grew up with some version of Dracula or another. I think my very first introduction to it was the Mel Brooks one, Dracula, Dead and Loving It. So I think that this is kind of right up my alley of, I think my first one would be the Count from Sesame Street, now that I'm thinking about it.
Oh, yeah.
Which is probably where I get my accent from.
I am the Count. Do you know why they call me the Count? Because I love to count things.
But yeah, no, it's been a constant fixture, I think, in everyone's pop culture life, from Twilight to True Blood to all those things. So I think this is right in line with all of that.
I remember the 1931 movie we watched monster movie. We loved Universal monster movies growing up. So I always loved Dracula. I loved Interview with a Vampire. I read that book, was obsessed with that at way too young of an age. I've always loved vampires. It's my first time I've ever getting to do anything with mm-hmm. Dracula or vampires before. So
yeah, same.
Yeah, and I saw this play last year in New York. We both saw this play last year in New York and fell in love with it. So it's so great to get to come and do it in San Diego now. Yeah.
Well, one thing it seems to be doing is not so much referencing Bram Stoker's Dracula, but referencing kind of our pop culture knowledge and memories of Dracula.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what I think is so great about that is because everyone has a different version that they grew up with. Some people love True Blood or Twilight or the books or Interview with the Vampire or Brad Pitt as a vampire. Mm-hmm. And so in referencing that, we get to take everyone's collective love for it and turn it into something that's really exciting and really accessible for them and very funny.
I read Bram Stoker's Dracula before I came in to do this, and it's wonderful, but there's very little similarity between this and the show. But what's so smart about this show is that it gives you what you think you remember. And it's just the thing of, like, you don't have to know anything about it. You're like, oh, right. Because I also watched a lot of movies about Dracula. I went and watched a lot of the Hammer movies, and every one of them have different rules about, like, you know, it's like, oh, sometimes he can have sunlight. Sometimes he's fine with garlic. Yeah. Sometimes you have to invite him in. And so I think the rules change every time. So it gave Gordon and Steve, the writers of our show, just free rein to kind of say, to make their own rules.
Yeah. And what's fun about it, too, is, like, there's always a different, sometimes Dracula is a sexy young guy, and sometimes he's a severe old man with the bun head, you know? So it's, we get to play around with that a lot.
Well, you mentioned accents, and this is a show where, again, it seems to be referencing other kind of accents we may have heard with these characters, as opposed to, like, oh, I'm going to try and do a really genuine Transylvanian accent. So what were you guys drawing on?
I wish I could say I had, like, a really, like, actor response to this, other than I just think this is what Transylvanian sounds like to me. So, like, I'm taking, again, different versions of things that I've heard in the past, and from the old black and white one, Count Chocula, all sorts, and kind of morphing it into my own version.
For Van Helsing, I'm sort of thinking Cloris Leachman and Arnold Schwarzenegger. sort of every now and then it comes out, I go, now, how? And I'm like, I'm just doing Arnold. But, you know, so what was great in rehearsal is that we absolutely had no dialogue coach whatsoever. And they gave us free rein to just, like, commit and pick a voice. Because, again, that's the spirit of the show. It's sort of like, we also, you know, the show is, we're a company of actors who come out and say, we're going to put on a show for you. So we put on a bunch of costumes. So it's just sort of like, this is what this actor thinks Van Helsing would sound like, or Dracula. Or
yeah, and it allows for so much more freedom because it's silly and we're all laughing together with this ridiculous thing that we've come up with. So I think it works really well in line with the show.
Now, there may have been a female Dr. Van Helsing somewhere in history, but I'm pretty sure this might be the only drag version of Van Helsing.
I think you're correct. I think it is the very first that I know of drag Van Helsing. Happy to be part of that lineage, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was that like creating that?
You know, I it's been so fun. In this show, I play two women in this show. And I never feel like the gender is the joke. So I never feel like, oh, I'm playing a woman that's inherently funny. I just think of the character as like, you know, who are they? What do they want to do? But I love playing women because there's such an emotional freedom. There's a range that they're able to play that I don't always feel like men get that, those opportunities to do that. And so I love that. I love that. The challenge of that. Plus, this show has so many jokes about misogyny and about patriarchy. And so it's funny because Linda Muggleson, who's brilliant in all male roles in the show, is constantly, you know, sniping on women. So like if a man did it, it would be boring and unlikable.
And those are the moments that usually stop the show.
Yes, because it's like, it's fun to have a woman playing a man bad-mouthing women. A lot of times I play women at, you know, just for the laughs. But in this show, there's a lot of like girl power and feminism, and it's a lot of fun. I rarely get to stand in that and sort of be proud for women, you know, for this moment. And it's ridiculous, but it's also fun to sort of say a lot of these things for the first time for me, like, you know, and what I get to play, yeah.
And this particular Dracula does play up on his vanity. Mm-hmm. And
you picked up on that?
Just a little bit. And one thing, I was here last night when there was the post-show forum.
Oh, yeah.
And you talked about a particular approach you took when you were auditioning. And
I don't know if it worked. It was just...
You got the job, here you are.
No, I was just saying that because I had seen the show in New York, I kind of knew what was up. Those were the moments that where the shirt comes off and everyone's so excited.
I am highly desirable.
That really made an impact. So I was like, okay, well, for my audition, I'm going to wear my tightest shirt. And alongside the callbacks, I'm going to post a bunch of shirtless pictures on Instagram and try and drum up a bit of attention. And I don't know if it helped, but
I'm here. And I went to acting school and I learned...
I never went to acting school.
Neither did I. Clearly.
Yeah. So, but that's that was my God's honest approach.
Well, and what do you think it is about Dracula that has kind of given him this longevity and kind of set him up as this romantic figure too?
Well, I think that there's something very seductive about the way that he's been written and the way that he's been played, that he's a lover. It's like, again, kind of seductive that he bites you on the neck. Like how beautiful and vulnerable is that? And he only does that by getting close enough to you to be there. So I think that lights up a lot of intrigue and fantasy in people.
And we're obsessed with youth. We're obsessed with staying young. And I think there's something very appealing about like stay young forever, stay alive forever. So I think that's just always one of those appealing things that people, you know, really, really enjoy.
Yeah.
Well, in addition to playing Van Helsing, you also play Mina, who has quite an intimate moment with Dracula.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I do play Mina, which if you follow the book, it's more like Lucy in the book. Mm-hmm. And Mina is, so they switch the characters around. I play a very unfortunate sister in the house who has a lot of issues. She got all the recessive genes.
She does
genes.
Her best.
She does the best she can. So she really is excited about this attention from Dracula.
Yeah.
And then Dracula realizes that, you know, spoiler alert.
She's a snack.
Yeah. And one of the things about the show is many of the actors play multiple parts. It's a theater in the round. So talk a little bit about kind of the physicality of this and how that plays into the comedy and just the challenges.
Yeah, well, I think what's really great about doing it in the round is that there's no place to hide. So you have no choice but to be completely invested the entire time. And it's really great because we can see everybody, and there's moments when we can really take the audience in and make them a part of it so that we're all kind of in on the same thing. And the stage is great because we can't have a very fancy, elaborate set because it would block people's view. So we have to make the story come alive ourselves and with our bodies and with our physicality. And it's like getting to do it in a big open gym. Mm-hmm. It's really fun. It's really fun.
And the audience can read your thoughts. And it almost is like we're on camera because they're right there. So you realize that it's such a broad, big, campy show and we play such giant characters, but there are other moments that it's like, oh, we can really just kind of throw that away or just kind of have the thought. And so we get to do a lot of different stuff that you wouldn't get to do in a bigger stage where you have to be a lot more grand and theatrical.
But it also seems like a Swiss watch kind of show where
that's such a great way to put it.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly.
Because it seems like if you miss one beat, you could like ruin everything.
This script is verbal farce like I have not done in so long, where our director who also wrote the show was like, one or can ruin the rhythm of the line. You have to really be on top of each other's energy, because otherwise it does go haywire.
And you really have to stay ahead of the audience, because they can get to the end of the idea before you do, and then if they do, then the joke isn't going to land. But so the pace is so important to stay ahead.
And what was it like working with this particular script?
Oh, wonderful. Great fun. Sometimes with a script, you have to find the jokes in them and really do a lot of work to lift it up and make it into something. But this one, a lot of times, you just have to say it. Like, the script is already funny, so you don't have to put a lot of extra acting on top of it. So it's been really super fun to get to work this style of comedy with this amazing group of people. We all really, really get it.
It's a play that reads funny, because a lot of things don't always read funny. It's all about the behavior, but you can read it, and the words are very. But it also works on multiple levels, because you have very funny jokes, and then you also have bizarre character behavior, and sometimes it's like fun to just watch someone. How are they blowing their nose, or how are they sort of walking, or how are they moving? And so like you get it works on multiple levels.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't the first time that this play has been mounted. Has it changed much? Has the director, who also co-wrote it, has he like trimmed it or revised
We mainly trimmed lines here and there that we didn't need in the space. The original version of the script was about 2 hours, I believe, and it's
The original, so it started off as because during COVID, it started as a podcast for 30-minute episodes of this play. And so when they finally did a staged version of it, they had trimmed it down and then trimmed it down again. And this version, I think, is largely the same as the New York version, but there was some New York specific jokes that had to get rejigged so that it wasn't so New York specific.
And do you have a like favorite part of this that you like to do? Is there a particular scene or aspect of it that you really enjoy?
You know, I really love my first costume. I'm not going to spoil it. But I feel so good in it.
Everyone loves it.
Yeah,
costume.
The costumes in the show are fantastic across the board. But my first costume specifically, I feel really sexy. That's all I'm going to say.
I love for us the end gets so wild and crazy that we just do not stop moving for the final 10 minutes of the play. It's just so fun to feel that physical and running across and throwing wigs on and ripping them off. And it's a play that gets more fun as it goes to do, I think.
And I think my favorite part, honestly, would be the audience's response, because they're having such a good time. Like, it's fun to watch them kind of figure out what show they're watching, and the laughter kind of builds and builds and builds and builds towards the end. And it's such a riot, like, to just look out and see people enjoying themselves, because it's great fun and it's a great escape. It's 90 minutes, no intermission, and you can just show up and laugh and just be in a room together. It's so much fun.
That was actors George Crissa and Drew Drogi speaking with KPBS's Beth Accomando. Dracula, a comedy of terrors, runs through November 3rd at the Old Globe's Sherrill and Harvey White Theater. Still ahead, Julia Dixon Evans speaks with Ari Shapiro about his new venture on stage.
It swerves and veers and lands someplace interesting, and it can pivot from pop to Broadway to classical to whatever genre you want to include in the mix.
KPBS Midday Edition returns after the break.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalich, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. You may recognize Ari Shapiro's voice and name as host of NPR's All Things Considered, but did you also know that he is a published author and often spends his free time on stage performing a cabaret-style show with the actor Alan Cumming? It's called Ach and Oi, a considered cabaret. They're coming to San Diego to perform at Humphreys by the Bay on Saturday. KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans sat down with Shapiro to discuss the many ways he shares stories with the world.
Ari, I want to go all the way back to when you first started mixing your public radio career with performance. You've toured and even recorded with Pink Martini, which is an American pop, jazz, world, and kind of retro orchestra. How did that collaboration begin?
Well, I grew up in Portland, Oregon, which is where Pink Martini is from, and I became friends with them over the years. And when I moved to Washington, D.C., they would come through town on tour, and I would have a cocktail party or brunch or cookout for them whenever they had a free night in Washington. And one year, it was about 2008, I think, one of those cookouts turned into a late-night sing-along around my piano with the members of Pink Martini and the members of another Portland band that happened to be in D.C. just then called Blind Pilot. And the next day, Pink Martini's bandleader, Thomas Lauderdale, called me and said, you know, we're in the process of writing this song for the next album that we want a man to sing. Why don't you come out to Portland and record it with us? And the song was called But Now I'm Back. And I first thought it would never happen. And then I thought, well, maybe that would be the one and only time I ever do anything with Pink Martini. And that was about 15 years ago. And now I've done one or two songs on each of the albums they've released since then. I performed with them at the Hollywood Bowl just this past summer. And I'm joining them on a few selected dates on their 30th anniversary tour, which is just wild to think about this band being 30 years old and still making great music and attracting audiences who are still interested in what they have to do.
Like you said, you are on several of their albums, but my favorite track is one from Je Dui, which is from 2016, and it is this Armenian love song, this ballad called Ov Sirun Sirun. Let's listen to that. I want to talk about cabaret. You're touring with Alan Cumming for a show called Ach and Oi, a considered cabaret. So what draws you to the cabaret genre?
I love the unexpectedness of cabaret. Like, I have admired lots of cabaret performers for a very long time, long before I ever started to make a cabaret show myself. And the thing about cabaret is it takes you on a journey, and it swerves and veers and lands someplace interesting, and it can pivot from pop to Broadway to classical to whatever genre you want to include in the mix. And I think it's a very personal art form where inevitably cabaret involves storytelling in addition to singing. And doing it with somebody like Alan Cumming, who is such a legend and such a kind of charming, witty, he's almost an older brother figure to me, but I think so many people have so many different associations with him, whether it is from The Good Wife or The Traitors or Cabaret, the musical Cabaret. I could keep going, the many things he's done over his career. It's really fun to share the stage with him, and I think we're kind of this odd couple. We're not an obvious pairing, and yet what we do has a certain spark to it that is, I think, hopefully more than the sum of its parts.
So what significance does cabaret have in LGBTQ plus history and in those communities?
You know, my dear friend, who I've admired since long before we were friends, Justin Vivian Bond, who is a legendary cabaret artist, primarily based in New York, but performs all over, just won a MacArthur Genius Grant. And as a MacArthur genius, gave a quote that I'm probably going to butcher right now. But it was something like creating beauty in the face of hate is a revolutionary act. Like I said, I'm paraphrasing. There's something about cabaret that is both inclusive and subversive. It welcomes people in even while undermining their expectations, taking them on a journey that they don't necessarily know where they're going. I mean, like, one of the things that, this is a random example, but it kind of indicates what I'm talking about. In our cabaret show, Alan and I are a little bit bawdy and crack some jokes that are maybe not appropriate for children. And I may even drop an F-bomb or two, which is so not what people expect from the Ari Shapiro they hear every day on public radio. I love that subversive quality to it. I am not going to destroy my credibility as a journalist. I'm not going to contradict the image of myself that is out there in the world on All Things Considered every day. But I might tweak it a bit. And that's part of the fun, I think, both of, you know, living with a queer identity and of playing in the sandbox of cabaret as a genre.
I love that. We all gasped out loud.
When I said I drop F-bombs?
Yes.
You should hear the it comes at a specific moment in the show. And if you come to the show, I hope you will say hi. And there's a specific moment. One of the nice things is having done the show for a few years now, like, we have found, we've honed the jokes, we've tightened the stories, we've figured out how it works best. And so we don't waste that F-bomb. We deploy it thoughtfully.
Okay, so take us there. Describe a moment on stage in the show.
Well, the thing that's really fun is that it changes a little bit every time we do it. The basic structure is the same, but there are moments, you know, when we started doing the show, he was not host of The Traitors and I was not host of The Mole. When we started doing the show a few years ago, I had not written a memoir. He had already written a memoir, but the show is loosely structured around the things that he and I have in common. And what's funny is that that list has grown and grown and grown. And so he recently, for the first time, joked that it felt a little bit like All About Eve, like I was coming for his gig. and I suggested that maybe he should try hosting a nightly news program.
I would listen.
I would absolutely listen.
What is it about reality TV that clicks for you?
It's funny, I was never a massive reality TV fan, but I've always been a huge fan of The Mole. Since its earliest days, it was this competition on ABC that Anderson Cooper hosted. It has always been hosted by a journalist. Netflix, a couple years ago, revived it with the MSNBC journalist Alex Wagner, who's a friend of mine. And I was so jealous just because I've always loved the show. And then when I found out that she wasn't coming back for the next season and they were looking for a new host, for me, it was not, I want to host a reality show. It was, I want to host The Mole.
Mm-hmm.
It's so fun and glamorous, and there's this kind of espionage intrigue aspect to it. And I love that every season is in a different country and every episode is in a different location within the country. So my season was set in Malaysia and we filmed for 6 weeks in the middle of the summer. It was very hot, but I just got to see this country in so much depth and range, from islands to jungles, caves and skyscrapers, big cities. It was an incredible experience. And I should say, people can watch it all on Netflix now. All 10 episodes are there.
So what is it then about public broadcasting that anchors you and keeps you doing it despite all of these alternate lives that you're sampling along the way?
Oh, I just love the range of things I get to do. I mean, you know, in one day alone, I spoke with this really thoughtful, incredible rabbi named Amichai Lau Lavi about the anniversary of the October 7th attacks. And in the same day, I spoke with Al Pacino about his new memoir. There are so few jobs in journalism or anywhere that encompass that range. And to me, one is not like the dues you pay in order to be able to do the other. To me, it is the both and that is really fulfilling. So hosting All Things Considered is a job where I know that every day I will learn something new. I will wake up in the morning knowing that by the end of the day, I'll know about something I didn't know when I started the day. And that's such a privilege. It never gets old.
That was Ari Shapiro, host of NPR's All Things Considered. He will take the stage with Alan Cumming in Ach and Oi, a considered cabaret, Saturday night at Humphreys by the Bay. He spoke with KPBS's Julia Dixon Evans, who joins me now. Julia, welcome.
Hey, Jade. Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you. Great interview there. And I know that you also, in addition to that, have a lot of weekend events for us to check out. Mm-hmm. So let's take a look at what's going on in arts and culture this weekend. Illustrator Carson Ellis is coming to the Book Catapult Friday night. What can you tell us about her work?
Yeah, so Carson Ellis, she's this illustrator and illustrated one of my favorite chapter books for young readers. I read it with my kids. It's called The Wildwood Chronicles. It's a series, and she worked on it with her husband, who is author and musician Colin Malloy from the band Decemberists. And she's also illustrated album art for the band for their entire career. So one of the things that I'm totally fascinated by with her is this long and creative partnership that she's had with her husband. And this book is like a gift to us because it's a series of paintings that she's made. It's all based on journal entries from a single week in January in 2001, right before she got together with her husband. But she referred to their friendship as, quote, bickering but inseparable friends on the verge of hooking up for the first time. And this was also her first week living in Portland. The book's called 1 Week in January, New Paintings for an Old Diary. And I really love the idea of like looking back on a journal that you wrote 23 years ago and adding in this new layer of art. And her paintings are so distinct. Like she has this really minimal but expressive style, feels very, very timeless. So she'll discuss the book at the Book Catapult in South Park on Friday at 7, and the event is free.
Wow, that's something you definitely don't want to miss there. The San Diego Ballet has a big production this weekend. What caught your attention about that?
Yeah, so this is two ballets in one, and they're both just really quintessential San Diego Ballet pieces, Firebird and Mambo Mania. So Firebird is by Javier Velasquez, the choreographer, and he's the longtime artistic director of San Diego Ballet. And this piece is like a folklore, funk, and hip-hop inspired piece of ballet. And then they also have Mambo Mania, which is what they refer to as a signature piece of theirs. It's an audience favorite, and the ballet uses the music of Perez Prado, who is this legendary Cuban composer and performer known, of course, for his mambos. And they're doing two shows, Friday night at 7 and then a Saturday matinee at 2. And these are both at the Joan B. Kroc Theater in Rolando.
And the monthly Barrio Art Crawl is this Saturday. What are some of the highlights?
So there's always so much going on in Barrio Logan during these events. All the galleries and the shops and restaurants are open. And you can also check out the Logan Avenue Artisan Market. They're doing like a spooky season version. And that's from 12 to 6. That's at 2100 Logan Avenue, which is right by the VFW. And then at Bread and Salt in Logan Heights from 5 to 8, they're having their monthly open house at the new Bernal Books newsstand. Artist Philip Brindle is doing a risograph print pop-up, which should be really fascinating. I love his work. And it's also a great time to check out all the current exhibits in the space, like Hugo Crosswaite's. There's a new work in the Quint One Gallery by Lisa Siegel. And you can visit the Bread and Salt Impact Artist in Residence, who right now is Koi Sun. He is the sign painter and content creator who's gone viral several times over the last couple of years, including when he made a video about applying for this very artist residency. And I recently visited Koi Sun in his studio where he's wrapping up the residency. And I really loved what he said when I asked him where sign painting falls on the spectrum of art and craft and trade.
You know, as a trade, like it wasn't that different from a plumber or a mechanic or something like that. And what I love about sign painting is the mix of trade in how I can functionally help people while still being artsy and doing design and having fun and being silly. One of the key signs when anybody is painting a mural is if you have people walking by and the first thing they ask is, "Oh, what's this business about?" And if they ask that question, it means you kind of did a bad job prepping the storefront.
Yeah, his signs are so great. It's really beautiful craftsmanship and lettering, kind of witty, but still these just really essentially honor the point of sign making. And when we visited, he was making a sign for his studio that said, "Fresh paint smell guaranteed."
Wow.
And he's there at Bread and Salt through the end of the month. So this will be your last chance to check him out during the Open Studios for Barrio Art Crawl. So yeah, 5 to 8 on Saturday, and this is always free.
All right. And before we go, what's going on in live music this weekend? You've always got the shows.
So tonight there is a band from Niger playing at the Casbah. This should be such a fun and unique show. This band, it's called Etron de l'Air. They perform this sort of guitar-heavy blues that's really popular in the Sahara region. And this is a track from their latest album. The album is called 100% Sahara Guitar. And Friday night at Courtyard, locals Mr. Tube and the Flying Objects, they're playing with Unwound. Unwound's an indie kind of DIY punk band from Portland. But Mr. Tube and the Flying Objects, they're locals. They're a long-running project of Paul Jenkins, who was also the frontman of Three Mile Pilot, Blackheart Procession, those really legendary local bands. This is a track called No Brains. And then on Saturday, we have an all-ages show. It's kind of lo-fi music at the Che Cafe. We have Fog Lake playing with Foxes in Fiction. And this is a track from Fog Lake called Motorcade. This just came out last year. It's really lovely.
A very mellow tune there. Well, I tell you what, you can find details on these and more arts events or sign up for Julia's weekly newsletter at kpbs.org/arts. I've been speaking with KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, thank you.
Thank you, Jade. This was fun.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Pacific Arts Movement, presenting the 25th San Diego Asian Film Festival, November 7th to 16th at theaters across San Diego, showcasing films from China, Philippines, South Korea, and Vietnam. For tickets and information, go to sdaff.org.